Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Over the past few years, you've probably heard a lot of news about big data and artificial intelligence. It has quickly grown to affect a lot of our daily lives, mostly in the form of companies finding very efficient ways of selling us things. Have you ever seen an advertisement trying to sell you something that seems really specifically targeted to you? I know I have. As soon as I started making a podcast, I started getting targeted ads for podcast equipment and hosting services. That's not your imagination, but it's not like someone is exactly watching over your shoulder as you browse the internet either. Rather, every link you click on, every video you pause on as you scroll past, that's data that you're sending someone. And when you add up all the internet activity of everyone on the planet, that is a ton of data. That's why we call it big data. So you can imagine that there's a big vested interest in the science of combing through all that data and figuring out what it can teach us. For example, if we know your online shopping habits, can we figure out your age, or your religion, or how you'll vote? The development of the science of big data analysis has massive implications for our society, some good, some a little scary, but whether you like it or not, it has become our reality. The concept of artificial intelligence or machine learning tends to go hand in hand with big data. When you have this much data, no one human can take it all in and make sense of it, but if you can teach a machine how to recognize patterns, then this machine can very quickly sift through all this data and try to figure out whether any such patterns exist. Maybe one day ChatGPT will be better at predicting the results of the next presidential election than Nate Silver. For all I know, that day's already arrived. But of course, it's easy to get scared by AI and big data, and of course, as with any science, there are ways that it can be misused. But fundamentally, all we're talking about are algorithms that are efficient at combing through data and finding patterns. And these algorithms don't have to be applied to personal data, they can also be applied in a very positive way to scientific data. And some of the scientists with the biggest data sets of all are astronomers. And astrophysicists are always trying to find new and unique ways to understand our big data sets. My guest today is one of the leaders in applying machine learning and big data algorithms to astrophysics. Her name is Dr. Ashley Villar, professor of astronomy at Harvard University, and we are here today to talk about how big data and artificial intelligence are changing the way we think about astrophysics. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast.
This is just for fun. I haven't figured out what I'm doing. This is certainly not going to be monetized ever, but it's...
You say that. You never know.
Well, I already get a paycheck. I don't need, you know...
How much do you think Dave Kippen gets? Don't record this.
More than me. We are recording it, but... so we should get started. All right. Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Ashley Villar, who is a professor of... astronomy.
Astronomy.
I should have checked first. Okay, professor of astronomy at the Center for Astrophysics, Harvard and Smithsonian.
That's right. You gotta pronounce the pipe.
You have a pipe in between. Dr. Villar, thank you for being on the program. How are you doing?
I'm okay. It's after lunch.
I know. I try to do these earlier in the morning. But it's not going to be quite as high energy. So it's nice to see you again. It's nice. We first met both when we were both at the CFA, Center for Astrophysics. Way back before COVID.
Yeah.
And so now we both have faculty positions.
It's great.
Let me start things off by talking about you personally and how you got to be a scientist before we get into the actual science. So let's start by telling me a bit about where you grew up.
Yeah, I grew up, I don't think you know this, so you don't know the can of worms. It's very minor, but I'm from Florida.
Okay.
And unfortunately, the closest landmark is Mar-a-Lago.
Oh, really?
It really is. Yeah, okay. I use the same airport.
All right.
But it's called Vero Beach, and it's a retirement beach town.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And so you grew up in a retirement beach home?
Town.
Oh, a beach town. You didn't grow up in a retirement
home. No.
All right, fair enough. Okay, and how was that?
It was great. I actually genuinely do like Florida. Uh-huh. They have a very strong public education system, used to. I know people don't know this.
Well, I had no sense of what their public education was like.
It's great. They have an online virtual school. So you can take all of your classes online. You can supplement your classes online, and it's at all levels. It's really great.
Wow. Well, yeah. I get you that they were happy to have that in place for COVID.
Yeah. I think they heavily relied on that. So yeah, that was really good.
So do you have like a memory of the first time you knew you wanted to do science or, you know, or physics or astronomy or something like that?
Yes. So I did not know. I really liked math as a kid. I was on the Mathletes from fourth grade onwards.
From fourth grade onwards.
Yeah.
Including today?
Still on there. Every year.
Okay.
No, I wish. That'd be very fun. But I didn't know. I didn't really take any science classes for a pretty long time. And then I specifically remember I saw Neil deGrasse Tyson on Jon Stewart's Daily Show.
Okay.
And he was talking about his new book, Death by Black Hole. And I was very captivated by the way he told stories.
Okay.
So I read his book, and that was like it.
Wow.
I just immediately wanted to become like a scientist.
Around what age was that?
I was in middle school.
You were in middle school, and you were like, that's what I want to do.
Yeah. That was it. And I just kept reading like pop science and then textbooks and then just knew I wanted to go study physics.
That's very cool.
Yeah. Very misguided.
Well, you know, we all get into it.
I'm so happy my parents were supportive of that.
Why do you say that? You think they wouldn't be supportive?
No, they would be, but I don't know.
Do you think your parents were influences on wanting to become a scientist, or?
They're not scientists. Mm-hmm. So yeah, my parents are like secretary and real estate agent.
Okay.
My uncle's an astronomer. Okay. So this is also weird, but that had nothing to do with me wanting to become an astronomer.
All right.
So my family's, my mom is one of 10. My dad's one of 7.
Oh.
And so like, I think statistically.
That's horrifying.
Yeah.
That's so many.
So one of my uncles is an astronomer. And I feel like I didn't know that until after I wanted to become one.
Oh, okay.
So very strange.
It just was kind of a peripheral notion.
And I don't
you
know
didn't
why.
Think about it.
Yeah, I think I didn't think about it. But yeah, he's great. He's in Hawaii.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So yeah.
Okay, so
it's in the family. Yeah.
That's nice. But your parents were at least encouraged. They were happy to see you go into science and stuff and have a direction for, because you were already into math. And,
yes.
But you discovered like, oh, this could be a cool path forward for me. Do you think that there were, any experiences you had when you were younger drove, I mean, I guess it was Neil deGrasse Tyson. Was that it? Like you just saw that and you were like astrophysics?
Yeah, I'm not even joking. It's so strange that he was like so. It was the book. The book was like, I don't know if you've read it.
I haven't. I'm sorry.
That's very fair. I don't know if you've read like Stephen Hawking's. Mm-hmm. I forgot. So that didn't do it for me.
Okay, you read that. You're like, nah.
Yeah, I was like, God, this is so boring. Like, no interest.
I liked it as a kid, but I didn't think of. I didn't immediately go. Then I wasn't gonna do this. I think I thought it was interesting.
That's fair.
But I don't know if the popular science. Brian Greene's book.
I've never read a Brian Greene book.
Really?
Yeah, I bet they're very good.
He's pretty good. And that's very like that. You know, that actually probably got me into thinking about it in terms of theory, right?
Oh, interesting.
Because his book is all string theory, and it's like just talking about really abstract ideas about how the universe could work.
Yeah.
And that got me very interested. And I think that probably put me in the direction of theory.
That is interesting.
So maybe there's a more influence there than I give credit. But I usually don't think of that as...
The moment. That's fair. Yeah.
But you saw you read Neil deGrasse Tyson's book and that was like okay, astrophysics.
Yeah,
so
you want to do. It was just really captivating.
That's cool. So is it just to give a sense of it, is it just covering everything in astrophysics, like black holes and?
Yeah, I have not read it in a very long time.
Okay.
But if I remember correctly, so it is pretty broad.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was actually a collection of short essays he had written for some magazine or something.
Okay.
Yeah, and one thing I liked about it, and I think this is why I liked it a lot more than the other pop science book, is that a lot of his life was injected into it, and a lot of how he saw astronomy as a way to communicate to the public. And I don't, like, for some reason, that, I think, helped me to see a human side to it and really gravitate towards doing that.
Okay. So then that convinced you, like, astronomy, astrophysics. And then, so then when you went to college, you said, like, you immediately were, like, astro major.
Yeah, I was a physics. They didn't have astro.
Okay, you said physics major.
But I was a physics major.
Okay.
And I knew I wanted to do astronomy, though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Very cool. So, I guess my next question is, when do you feel like you really started learning how to be a scientist? I know, that's not, it's pretty vague. I know, these questions aren't very good, I apologize.
What? Paul! Oh my god. So great.
Okay.
Wait, when did I feel like...
Honestly, I always feel like if it makes them think too much, it's not a very good question.
No. I think it is a good question. I think the answer is just like kind of late, and so I'm just thinking, I feel like I didn't get...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how... I didn't think like a physicist until well into graduate school, in my mind.
I'm the same way.
Okay.
I would say it was about my third year or fourth year of grad school until I was like...
comfortable with doing kind of stupid things. Like, I feel like that was it. It's like playing like, with...
What about if I just try this?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, just saying like, actually, I do know enough to like try this thing.
Yeah.
And play with the idea.
Yes.
And I feel like that didn't happen until I was...
I would say I'm exactly the same way. It took me, you know, because when you first get into grad school, you find an advisor and they give you things, and then you say, okay, I could do that task.
Yeah.
But yeah, it takes a while before you start to go like, oh, this is what you're trying to figure out. What if we did this? You know.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And just being very comfortable.
You know,
with
it takes years before you get into that mode.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
anyway,
it took a while.
That's fine. No, that's I think that's exactly. I couldn't agree more. So let's see. So that was grad school. So you where did you do your undergrad?
I went to MIT.
At MIT, and then you went. Okay, so then you went to.
So
you just stayed in Cambridge.
Let me explain why I did, because it's not a good reason.
Okay.
So I met my husband in college. And he had a job in Boston.
Oh, okay.
So I decided, I really...
So you're in college at MIT, and you're like, we got to stay in Boston. Well, I guess I should go to grad school at Harvard.
That is like, actually, I didn't visit any other school.
Really?
No, it was bad.
That was a bad idea, it worked out for you. But
yeah,
man.
I was like, oh, I really like this guy, and he has this job. Also, I'm sure he would have moved. So he has the same job now.
Oh, okay.
He hasn't switched jobs.
He's managed to stay in the same job. That's because you just only briefly left the Cambridge area.
Yeah, and then we just came back because we're like, you know, this one job is holding it all together.
Apparently. Well, it's worked out for you, and I'm happy it has. But that's kind of just, I'm actually kind of disgusted because if you've got, it took me... 3 times applying to grad school before I got into one.
I remember
one.
That, yeah.
And it was not Harvard.
Which is very incredible, though. Okay, but you went to NYU.
I went to NYU, yeah.
That's a great school.
It is a great school. I know. I'm just saying, yeah. I would never have been able to get away with just, I'll just apply to Harvard.
No, I applied to lots of places.
Okay.
And then I didn't visit any of them.
And you didn't visit any of them. You just were like, Harvard.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Well, that's better.
What
I thought
No, I did.
You were like... Babe Ruth pointing at the stands
that would
and just
be
like,
impressive.
Nah, Harvard, that's where I'm going.
No, that'd be extremely impressive. No, I applied very broadly,
okay.
And then I said, all right, this is good enough.
Harvard is good enough.
So
I will give you that. It is good enough. Well, that's good. Actually, that's fine. That's perfectly fine. It's perfectly so.
Now
I mean, you're staying in the same place, but, you know, which I think it is good. It is better if you can go, you know, see other things, but, you know, that's okay. You know, it's Harvard's great. There's no, you shouldn't turn down them just because.
Because you should.
Because there's somewhere else to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's cool. So you did undergrad at MIT. You went to grad school at Harvard, and that's where we met.
Yes.
And then COVID happened, and we kind of both disappeared.
The ether.
We both vanished.
Yeah.
But so then you quickly got an offer at Penn State, and then
I deferred it for a year.
Okay.
And then I went to be a Simons Fellow. For a year.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, we can edit a lot of this out. But anyway, that's fine. This is good stuff. No, it's great. anyway, So now you're an astrophysicist.
Yes,
so
yes.
Let me ask you, we talked a little bit about this earlier, before we started recording, but what are some of the things you like the most about your job?
I do really enjoy that it's not just you can do your own research and you can choose a direction, but it's also just kind of wild to me that we can choose a direction that a team of humans will collectively work to answer. Like, you can really answer questions. Isn't that cool? So,
I guess I'm not sure I understand the concept you're articulating. Just like that, you can say, "All right, we're all going to push forward together and find out the answer to this."
Yeah, that you can set the direction.
Mm-hmm.
With very little, like, monetary influence.
Right.
Of just something you are genuinely curious
right. you
about.
You can just tell people, hey, I want to know why this is.
Yeah.
And if you make a compelling argument, you get lots of people
excited about it,
and then they try to answer that question.
Yeah, and then you can answer it as a team. It's just really cool.
That is very cool. I guess I never had it put that way before. I didn't thought about that way. But that is very cool because it's in other fields you'll have teams that work to do something, but it's not like answering a question about the universe. It'll be
yeah.
to like
make we have
a,
so much flexibility to yeah. just do anything. Like, it is weird. So we're in the same field.
Yeah.
Of time domain astrophysics.
Well, I work on everything, but yes.
That's even more everything. You can do anything you want and just select a question.
Yeah.
And then answer it.
Yeah, well, I don't usually answer it, but I usually write a paper that's like, well, this is what I found anyway, but...
Pretty sure it's much harder than this. That's fair.
But I do get what you're saying. It is kind of incredible, and that it is, you're answering questions that, like, humanity doesn't know the answer to, and you're just like, let's get a team together and just
solve
do it.
Yeah, just figure out how to do it.
I think that's very cool. But it's interesting that your answer is not, and it's not obviously astro-specific. I mean, it is in a sense, because astro is big. It's, these deep cosmological questions about the universe and things like that. But, like, you know, it's
but this could be about anything.
This could be about a lot of things, any kind of science, right?
Yeah.
But it is, for astro, it does specifically feel like we're doing something that's...
I feel like we get, in astro, very large pieces of the universe we are allowed to think about.
Yeah.
Like, in biology, I say this not knowing anything about biology, but in biology...
That's fine. You're the biology expert in the room right now, so...
You heavily specialize, though. You do. Like,
yeah, that's
you have
true.
Pretty specific set of skills. Eventually, I guess the PIs have extraordinarily large teams, but
right.
that's because everyone specializes.
Right.
And I feel like we get a...
In
you
astro,
specialize
that's
in
true.
Theory.
That's
wild.
That's
what does
true.
That mean?
In astro, we don't... And I... Yeah, you're right. I'm the least specialized person that I know, probably. But yeah, you're right. It is true in astro, especially... I think transient astrophysics, especially.
Yeah.
We just kind of like, I could probably learn
yeah.
about that.
Yeah.
We
like,
don't,
that thing explodes. Yeah, probably I could figure that out. That's so
it's probably
weird.
Similar to this other thing that I worked
yeah.
on that exploded.
I'm sure it's not.
It's not anyway. It's a totally different phenomenon, but I can, try my hat at it. That's true. There is a lot of flexibility there. I
yeah.
do like that. That is, I hadn't appreciated it until you said that, but that is really nice. I will probably edit this question out, but is there anything you don't like about your job?
You know what I don't like that's weird?
Okay.
I don't like all the travel.
Oh, the travel.
I actually don't like it.
I totally agree. So thank you for coming to West Lafayette, Indiana. But I actually kind of agree with you. I don't like the whole, like, I hate getting on planes.
Yeah, me
I
too.
I hate, like, you have to plan in advance and go, like, okay, now I have to get the tickets and I have
yeah.
to do the, like.
Like, I don't know, are you, like, a touristy vacationer or, like, a beach do-nothing vacationer?
I am a.
or I don't, not, don't
I
like
don't,
vacation.
I'm not a beach person. I don't like. I will burn. I burst into flames.
Okay, well.
But I don't. I more like. I don't know. I'm happy to relax in my own home. So
I'm also like that.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be weird. But I'm in no vacation.
But now there's one other person in the room that can
now
do that.
Now I'll admit.
I'll vacation. I'll go to see my parents, you know, or something like that. But I
like
don't
staycations.
Usually,
like, I just... Yeah.
Or go... I don't mind going to check out, like, a city that I haven't been to somewhere in the world, as long as I don't know anybody there. Like, as long as I don't, like... As long as there's not, like, work I could
that's
be doing
much,
there.
Oh, okay,
you know what
okay.
I mean? When I say I don't know anybody, I mean, there's a lot of cities. Like, if I go to Copenhagen, I have a collaborator there, I could go to, you know, and I do actually like doing that, too, but then I get in work mode, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not really a vacation then.
Yeah, that's very fair. That is another thing. All my vacations that are travel now are just linked to work.
you always
tie them
in.
Like, yeah, I'm the going there anyways.
Exactly.
And then it's,
oh yeah, that's what, yeah. Every time I go to New York, I can't help it.
Yeah.
I can't help it. I'm always doing work. But anyway, yeah, that's true. I don't know. I'm weird. I would prefer to be able to not travel, except like I do like seeing people.
Yeah.
I just would like
have
to travel to do it.
I also love, like, I like conferences.
Yeah, yeah.
I like socializing with people. Yeah, but I just...
Yeah, that's why I'm organizing conference to have other people come to me.
That's right.
I don't
have
to have...
That's the real strategy. Yeah. That's what we should do.
Exactly.
One conference.
That's right. Everyone come to me. I don't have to come up with plane tickets. Yeah, I just have to organize a conference. How hard could that be? So what would you say motivates you the most in your professional life? Like, what gives you the energy, excitement to work on hard problems?
I think, so you gotta work with a lot of very young people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always really fun. I feel like every year we literally interact with people where it's the first time seeing material. And they get so excited.
That makes me
get excited again.
That is fun. So are you like saying like the new group of undergrads that come in or a new group of grad students?
Both. Yeah. Or even postdocs who are like clearly very well educated in a field, but they typically switch to some new project. And they're just so excited to learn about the literature, to learn about the ins and outs
that's
of how
true.
To code it up.
That
yeah.
is very fun.
So I do like that part.
That is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It also, it's like, you also feel, it's not just motivates you, but you also feel like kind of obligated to get, you know, like, oh, well, they'll be expecting me.
It is honestly, it's a little exhausting to be the cheerleader. You are the cheerleader 24/7.
Yeah.
But in the beginning, it's so exciting.
It is very fun. But then you go like, well, time to get the pom-poms out again.
Yeah.
So... All right. Very cool. So let me shift gears and talk, you know, let's go move to talking about your science. So to start out, let me ask you, when you meet a new grad student or mm-hmm. fellow scientist and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
So I am like you and say that we work on a pretty broad range.
Okay.
And we focus on observational studies of extragalactic transients.
Observational studies of extragalactic...
That's half of it.
...transients.
And
all right.
We use data-driven methods to do that.
All right, let's see if I can deconstruct that. So observational, meaning you're not doing theory, you're using...
Yes.
You're an observer, or you're using observational data in some sense.
Yeah.
So you're actually looking at the thing, you're not just theorizing about it.
We take data,
So that's the observational part. So what is it? Observational studies
extragalactic.
Of... Extragalactic.
Yes.
So not in our galaxy.
Yes.
But some, and could be in other galaxies.
That's right. Yeah. So a good example are supernovae, which mm-hmm. is what happens when stars die. Mm-hmm. They blow up, literally like atomic bombs.
Right.
And that only happens once a century in our own galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
So you should look at lots of galaxies to try to capture
a
nice sample.
So we get
of
like
them.
One a second in the observable universe. Is that right? I think I remember hearing
it's
that at some point.
So this sound, I don't know.
Okay.
I would need to recalculate.
I remembered somebody once telling me it was once a second in the observable universe, but in our own galaxy, it's only one a century.
Yeah.
So we have to wait a while if we want to see them in our own galaxy.
Yes.
But maybe we will, but you can't count on it.
Even if we do see it, we're not going to see it because it's going to be in the disk.
Oh. Is that right? We're not going to be able to see because it'll be in.
So there's lots of stuff in the way.
Oh, the galaxy's
there's
in the
dust
way,
in,
basically.
Yeah.
Well, that's annoying.
Yeah.
But so that's why you specify extragalactic transients.
Yes. Yeah.
Because but you didn't really have to say extragalactic. You just wanted to sound smart, right?
No.
but are there people?
I do have to specify.
But if people work on galactic transients, what would that be? Like old classical novae.
Yes.
That we look for in our own. Okay. Yep. Fine. Sorry, I'm trying to get under your skin so that you
defend.
That way it'll be a combative
why?
Podcast. I don't know. I'm just trying things. It's only the third time I've done this. No, it's fine.
In this one, I'll make them cry.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know what I'm doing here, but so when you say extragalactic transients, you mostly mean supernovae, but basically very bright transients so that you could see them in other galaxies.
Yes.
So it could be other things. There are these. It could be but we can think about supernovae, I guess, for the purposes of.
Yeah, I think supernovae. It is so. It's the vast majority of supernovae. I only keep it open because very occasionally. Neutron stars hit each other.
Right.
And we will see something called a kilonova.
Right.
But we haven't seen one of those in a bit, so.
We haven't seen one of those since 2017. But
yes, kind of. There was a recent paper.
Oh, right. There was another one.
Yes.
That's right. So we do see them.
Yeah. Yes.
But it's good to keep it broad so that you can be like, well, I can work on that a bit.
Exactly.
Why not?
Yeah.
Okay, but we can think about supernovae for the most part.
Yeah.
Was that the whole sentence that I deconstructed there?
Yes, I think so.
Oh, but you use data-driven
methods.
Okay, so what does that mean?
So we discover 20,000 supernovae every year.
20,000 supernovae every year?
Yes.
Okay, that seems like a lot.
It is a lot. And soon, in 2025,
mm-hmm.
a new observatory is coming online, Vera Rubin Observatory,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically going to take an incredibly deep video of the southern sky. Terrible frame rate, but a video.
But a deep, very slow frame rate video.
Yeah, and it's going to allow us to discover 1 million supernovae every year.
Supernovae every year.
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to see 1 million supernovae per year. So what do we do with that?
Yes. So you can do a few things with that. So broadly, we think about answering first questions in real time, meaning when a supernova goes off,
mm-hmm.
it's like a bomb and it goes away. So we can only see them for a few weeks at a time.
Right.
And so if you want to get more data to really understand the physics,
right,
you have a 2-week window to do it.
Right. So it's not like, I'd like to learn something about Betelgeuse. You can look at it anytime you want. But if I want to look at that galaxy and understand it, you can do that.
It'll always be there. Yeah. But, or even transiting planets.
Or like, they'll transit again.
They'll come back. It might take a while, but they will come back. Yeah.
So then, but with transients, supernova.
Yeah.
You got that brief window, and then I guess the earlier you catch it, the better, right? Probably.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Paul.
I know, but I do a lot of asking questions I already know the answer to. But that's, you know.
It is true, though. Yeah. So the earlier, the easiest way to say it is, the earlier we can catch them, the more physics you can extract. There really is a lot of information at the very earliest phases when mm-hmm. that stuff that's exploding is mm-hmm. closest to the star, the progenitor itself.
Oh, okay. So in other words, it has just exploded, so it hasn't expanded out very far.
Yeah.
And so that very early stage, you're learning more about what the
surface of what that star looked like.
I see.
At time explosion, as an example.
Okay.
Many other reasons, too.
many other reasons that we don't have to get into immediately. But the point is, there's a million of these things.
Yeah.
So what does that translate? You probably already know these numbers, right? A million a year is how many a day?
It's over 1,000. I can't remember if it's quite 2,000.
It's like a couple thousand.
It's a few thousand
each
a day.
Each night it'll see a couple thousand or whatever. Yeah. And so you go, okay, which of these few thousand supernovae should I...
decide
pay attention to.
Yeah, and it's in some ways, I don't know, it's worse in that if you really want to understand something, that's like a year-long endeavor for a student, a postdoc, mm-hmm. us. And so it really is a small fraction that you have to decide you want to spend time understanding deeply.
Oh, in other words, the supernova itself may only last for a couple weeks.
Yeah, but you also need to manage your human time.
Right.
Yeah.
You can't just be looking at every, like putting all of your focus on every supernova.
Yeah.
You only have so many hours to yourself.
Yeah, I mean.
And you're going to want to, as scientists, we want to look at the most interesting things, I guess. So we want to have impact, and we want to look at the things that we're going to learn the most from.
Yeah. I think there's, and it's a sociology question of mm-hmm. what does it mean to be the 1 in 1 million level of importance
right.
to science?
So which is the important supernova is a very abstract question.
Yeah.
And different scientists would probably have different answers.
Yeah.
For them.
Yeah. And for us, the thought is that we will have a chance to look for and study 1 in 1 million level high energy astrophysics.
So like really rare things that only happen once every million.
Yeah.
1 in 1 million.
Explosions.
Yeah. We'll be able to catch those.
Yeah.
But we have to figure out which ones those are.
Yeah, exactly.
And so that's where, that's part of the whole point of what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. We use data-driven methods to figure out which of those could represent new physics.
Okay. So what does it mean to, okay, so I, what does it mean to use a data-driven, I know this
yes.
is,
yeah.
You know, I know we are in this world of big data, and people
yes.
talk about big data a lot.
Yeah.
And so I guess when you say data-driven, it's meant to be sort of loaded in that sense, is that we're somehow using our new technologies that we're developing.
Yes.
To manage
yes.
all this data.
Yes. A different way of what I'm... So we use a lot of machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, we use representation learning, which just means... So you can imagine if you want...
just for the listeners, she laughed because she saw an extreme look of confusion on my face. But anyway, go ahead.
So you can imagine if you wanted to teach a new student how to identify a specific type of supernova, something, you would show them lots of examples of data, and you would tell them, this is this type. Type A mm-hmm. supernova is type B, this type C.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll teach them how to find type A.
Right.
What we're doing is showing a computer many examples of supernova data.
Mm-hmm.
We don't tell them what they're looking at,
the computer.
The computer,
right.
We don't tell the computer
what it's looking at.
We just show it lots of data.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it learns an abstract model of what, in general, a supernova looks like.
Okay.
And then what you can do is it will naturally, not really, we like mathematically help it out a mm-hmm. lot. It can sort the different types.
So it, you don't have to tell it there are these categories.
Yeah, we don't do that.
The algorithm itself figures out that there is, okay, this is its own category. We see a lot that look like this.
Yeah.
This is a different category of supernova.
And we do help it out, but yes.
Of course you're going to prod it. You're like, yeah, that's called a 1A.
But that is the idea. Yes.
Yes.
Is that it builds a little mind map.
Mm-hmm.
It's computer mind.
And, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. And then the idea is that then you don't have to. So, okay, if I'm looking for 1 in 1 million physics, I probably... Unless, Paul, you've given us a model of 1 in 1 million
no.
physics. Not yet. So.
I try not to go for those things, but I try to give the 1 in 2 models if I can. But,
okay. Yeah, so we don't have a model, right? Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Right.
But
because it's one in a million, so it's likely to be something no one's thought of.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, or some.
Or it might be something someone came up with, like, in the 70s or something
and
put a paper
up. We ignored it. Yeah. And so that's the idea, is that if I have taught this computer, though, to build out this mind map, and it's naturally clustering things into categories, mm-hmm. it can be sensitive to something that doesn't look like anything else. Even if I don't know what the physics, I can't write down the physics. Mm-hmm. If it really looks distinct, a neural net can pick that out.
But so now, here's my, so if it's really, you're in a one in a million situation, there's got to be a bunch of garbage that it also finds, right? Because there will be,
yes.
For example, you know, this telescope wiggled a bit or something, and that, you know, or something, I don't know, there was some...
No, it's true, yeah.
There's something weird, and that a normal astronomer would have been like, okay, I screwed that up.
Yeah.
But...
No, this is, this is a big concern, and this is where a lot of the actual work and math goes into, mm-hmm. is making sure that that mind map obeys some laws of physics. Like,
oh, really?
Yeah. So, for example, you want it to be invariant to certain symmetries, meaning, so a different way to say, like, if I have a supernova that's sitting in the next galaxy over, and I have the same type of supernova really far away,
uh-huh.
I might want the mind map representation to be the same, because I know it's the same
right.
type of
supernova. So if they just see, if they're just, they should be able to tell.
Now that's the same thing.
It's the same thing, just seen further away.
Yeah, and I do know how distance impacts my data.
Right.
I know it gets dimmer. I know that time dilation happens.
Right.
I know it gets redder. And so I can write that down mathematically.
Right. Okay, so you you can put, when I was thinking physics, I was thinking even more involved, but okay, I see, in other words, there are certain things that makes sense that you want the algorithm to know, is like, okay, if you see something that's, you know, dimmer and redder, and you can rescale it to imagine what that would look like in a nearby galaxy, and so that they would be in the same category.
Yeah. But that doesn't quite connect to your question. The idea is, once you build in that physics, mm-hmm. the hope is that your bugs cluster in a weird way that is clearly aphysical or unphysical. Yeah.
I see. Anything that's very, anything that's a contaminant that's not meant to be, that isn't your nice one in a million events.
Yeah. And I'll say, like, that remains to be seen. It's also... this problem of what's called, like, real bogus classification. So if it's a real astrophysical thing versus mm-hmm. bogus, is actually one of the oldest machine learning problems in astronomy.
Really?
Yeah, they've been working on this for
real
decades.
Real or bogus?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
They're pretty good at it.
I've never heard that terminology.
Yeah, Josh Bloom.
Okay.
Did a lot of work in this.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. So that's a longstanding issue, but we're learning ways of trying to mitigate that, and hopefully that will find the actual one in a million real events.
That's the hope.
Yeah. We're still, the Baron-Rubin Observatory is not there yet, so we don't have the million to look through.
Yeah, we have the 20,000.
We have the 20,000, so we can maybe see, and now are we seeing one in 20,000 type events?
So, it's an interesting question. The answer.
There's no weird rare thing that we've discovered after looking at 20,000 a year?
I mean, yes, but I don't know what their intrinsic rates actually are.
Oh, okay.
But there are some new classes. So there are new classes we're discovering every year.
Mm-hmm.
So a good example now, but I just don't remember the intrinsic rate or if mm-hmm. anyone's even done this calculation.
Mm-hmm.
Type 1CN supernovae.
Type 1CN supernovae.
Yeah, have you heard of this?
I have a guess as to what it is, but go ahead.
Okay. Type 1 means that there's no hydrogen.
Okay.
The C means that there's also no helium.
Right.
And the N means that you see narrow emission lines.
Right.
Those lines aren't they're not hydrogen and helium. It turns out they're carbon and oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
So we see things that look like quark collapse supernovae that seem to be cocooned in their own shell of like carbon material.
Okay. So, all right. So, good. I brought this on myself by asking for an example of a weird, rare event.
Yeah, this is the issue.
But yeah, that's fine. But the idea is it's something that, not even a standard core collapse supernova, but an unusual one that had lost all of its both hydrogen and helium envelopes.
Yeah.
And then so it's somehow one way or another, and then it exploded, but it also ran into something else after exploding.
That's carbon rich. Yeah.
But so you can imagine, I guess that's a good example of the type of thing you would see when you're looking for rare things is, okay, it did all of these things and then exploded and then it did this other thing, which is like, we see each of those separate components in supernovae, and this is just an example of like, what if they all happened? And, you know, every once in a while that would...
Oh, sure. I see what you're saying. Yeah. It is the case that it's not new. This isn't new physics.
Mm-hmm.
This is an extremely rare set of astrophysical ingredients coming together.
Right.
Yeah. Which can still be incredibly rare.
Right. Yeah. No, but that helps me calibrate my mind. So that's but there are, of course, there are other things that are entirely like we wouldn't have a letter number classification like that because we don't even know.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of these are now just theories of you don't like these, but
no, it's okay. Go ahead.
Our process supernovae are a good example.
Right.
And we had a paper where we asked what would happen if you basically were a massive star that almost entirely made very heavy elements and exploded. This would literally be a 1 in 1 million LSST. Like, we did the calculation.
Oh, really?
It's very rare if this happened.
Really? I didn't even know how you would guess how rare that was because, anyway, but that's another story. But somebody did the calculation.
Yes. Yeah.
And so every once in a while so you're saying the whole thing burns to being heavy elements, or what was the description?
So it's an incredibly massive star, like 100 solar masses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and the idea is that this is a collapse star event, and in that process of forming the disk, like the standard collapse star model with the R process enhancement, that you can make R process.
I see. So the idea, just to clarify for my parents or the remaining listeners that are still listening, we have. The idea is it's really massive star, 100 solar, 100 times the mass of the sun, and it collapses, and what would normally just form into a black hole, and just we wouldn't see anything. It instead, it does form a black hole at the center, but then you also it was spinning fast enough.
That's right. So some of it
formed into a disk around the black hole that the black hole ate up, and then that produced an outflow. Okay, so that's a good point. So this is what I get when I ask, what are the really exotic things that were 1 in a million?
Yeah.
That's
pure theory.
That's pure theory, because we haven't actually seen that. But it's just an idea of, okay, this is what we might see if we get to see these 1 in a million type events.
Yes.
That's very cool. But, you know, but then that's a good question, because, okay, we can come up with that, and then we can say that happens 1 in a million times.
Right.
But how many other things that we didn't come up with?
Right.
Are there going to be? Because that, you know.
I think that, and that's why we're taking this agnostic approach.
Right.
The idea being, well, we don't know.
Right.
So we're just going to learn patterns really well and then figure out when something's not following that pattern.
Right. So do you think of it like, you know, back, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we'd see only a few supernovae a year or something.
It's true. In the 80s, it was like a dozen per year.
In the 80s, it was like a dozen per year, and you could just have the astronomer just look at it and go like, oh, okay, well, I see
some helium. Even today, we do a lot of that.
Well, yes, even today, they do a lot of that. But now, you know, you're having an AI basically replace that process. When you have this huge amount of data, you can't just have one person go, oh, okay, well, I see some hydrogen.
Yeah.
And also, I would hope, I don't know, maybe it will be, but I would hope that you would be that process would be a little bit more scientific than just kind of staring at a spectrum and going, I think that's probably a little bit extra helium there, and...
Well.
maybe not.
That's still an art.
It is still an art.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I guess that's a good point. I guess it's replacing one sort of art form with another, I guess. But
yeah.
Because the AI, you have to, you know, there's a lot that goes into the training of it, I
guess. There is. And what I'm talking about, too, is... it's not Spectra, so we don't get this nice little picture of all the fingerprints of the elements there.
Right. So in other words, instead of just seeing a spectrum, in other words, like all the, you know, the light coming in different frequencies and being able to say that there's a line from absorption of helium or something,
yeah,
you can't do that anymore because the data is not...
We don't. It's too expensive.
It's all you're seeing is just how bright it is at each time, at a given time.
That's... We're just... Basically. Yeah. We're basically seeing how... blue and bright is it versus how red and bright is it
instead of having much more coarse grained as data, but there's a lot more of it.
Yes.
So that's I guess there's two challenges at once.
Yes.
Is that there's more but less.
But we're still trying to play the same game of guessing what type of star exploded, but with the worst data.
Worst data for any given individual event. But then I guess that gets into a separate question, rather than just thinking about the one in a million events, but thinking about, okay, if I have just this tiny amount of data, can my AI figure out from this little amount, extrapolate what the rest of the data looks like?
Yeah. What do you want me to say?
I don't know. I don't know where I was going with it, but okay. But I just thought you might have something to say about that.
Yeah, I think, what do I think about that?
Or I guess in other words, like
there's like two things. Like there's
implicitly, if you're saying, I think because I see these colors at this time and these colors at this time, I think this is a type 1A supernova.
Yeah, is the hard part.
Right.
It's
implicitly that implies it's extrapolating what the rest of the data kind of looks like.
That is what it's doing. It's doing like pattern recognition, and the hard part of this is that you are now doing a lot of statistics. I'm pretty sure this is type 1A supernova,
right.
But I could be wrong with 20%, 20% chance I'm wrong.
Right.
And so that's the other thing we're thinking a lot about is how do you put together lots of observations, but you were never actually sure what you saw.
Right. So your information that you have, it's different than it used to be. You'd see one event and you'd say, like, this is a type 1A, and what can I do with this? Now you see a million events and you say, some percentage of these, I'm 80% sure, are type 1A supernovae.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of data.
Yeah.
So there's a lot you could potentially do with it, but figuring out how to make use of that.
That's right, yeah. So the field's kind of moving away. It's not moving away from, we'll still have this forever, but... You know, it's going from only using case studies of very well-studied events to using populations of those events to learn something deeper about
them generically.
Yeah.
Like, what does it mean to be a type 1A supernova?
Exactly. Like, what... I do poor collapse for you.
Right. I always jump to 1A.
Boring.
But I find 1A is very interesting. But core collapse, but core collapse are interesting as well, and they're very messy, and so they're a lot of fun. There's a lot going on in it. But
But even just asking a question like what sort of massive star leads to the most common type of core collapse supernova we see, type 2s, and we don't really know the demographics of those stars.
Yes, that's right. Because we don't usually, most of the time, we don't have an image of what the star looked like before it exploded. Usually we see the bright flash and we go, I wonder what that star was.
Yeah, exactly. And we still won't have a lot of those in the future.
So there's a handful.
Yeah.
But, and maybe we'll get more.
We'll definitely get more.
Of course we will, Paul. Why would we stop getting more?
But we'll now have like millions of them to work with, and you could imagine, even if no individual event, I'm 100% sure I understand what star it came from. Collectively, I understand distributions of the properties of those explosions.
I see.
And so I can start thinking about, okay, well, what collection of stars has to lead to that?
I see. So it is a very different way of thinking about how to do it is just generally a different way of thinking about how to do astrophysics.
Yeah.
Because it is turning it into a statistical question, like you said.
Yeah.
I'm no longer because I want to know generically about what causes stars to explode in a more general sense. It becomes a more statistical question because any one event tells you what that particular supernova was.
Yeah, but the observable's no longer the single event. It's the sum of them all.
It's the sum of all of the event, the data from all of the events.
Yeah.
Wow. So that is a lot of data.
It is a lot of data.
So what, I mean, and I know this, you know, this is exactly what you do. You do data. This is your whole thing. And so it's good timing for you to be coming along and being able to work through it. So like, what would you say was the most impactful thing that you've ever done, or what would you say the most interesting thing you've done with this big data technology?
I think so. We're very much at the beginning of this. Mm-hmm. Like when I started my PhD, I don't think there existed a real photometric classifier, what I'm describing.
Okay.
And so we were really the first people to do this.
To do this, to be able to write an AI that could classify a supernova based on just the light that came from it from a few epochs.
And classify it into the traditional way we would, the traditional buckets that normally we had to get spectroscopy to do.
Right.
And now it's very, like, that's bread and butter. It is common to do this now with big surveys.
Okay. Because once you've written the algorithm, people can just use your...
They don't use mine, but...
Oh, okay. Well, you know, I would. If I ever handled data.
Good.
I'm white gloves, though. I don't touch the data. But so... So then, okay, but so would you say that was like sort of your big contribution was doing that? Then, I mean, what is it? Has there been? So you're saying we're in our infancy, so we haven't really. We're just getting to the point where we will be able to like really do something powerful with this.
Yeah.
Because astronomers are already excited because they know that this is a really powerful technology.
That's
but
right,
we're just on the verge of actually using it and making use of leveraging this big data set that we're getting.
That has what's been very fun about my group is just what we talked about, like really rethinking how we even consider the observational questions we've been asking. Because the type of data is so different than what we've had before.
Wow. Wow, that's pretty crazy. So you must have some profound conversations about this stuff.
I can't tell you're making fun of me.
No, I have that effect. But I'm just picturing you like in your group meetings, just being like, well, okay, what if we think of, you know, how do we think about our data now? Like we have, you know, anyway, I mostly with my group meetings, we just kind of chat about what why our code isn't compiled.
I mean, that's what we talk about.
Okay, good. All right, well, that makes me feel better then.
I think, unfortunately, it's a lot of statistics.
Right.
And that's less fun sounding when you actually get into it. I think it's very fun.
Well, it is an interesting point. So statistics doesn't seem like as fun because you're not looking at one event. If you look at one event, you can go, look at this
thing.
I know,
you're telling a story. There's like a whole story behind it.
There's a story. Yeah. You can tell the story of the supernova. But now it's statistics. You're just saying, it feels very, you know, like machine learning. The machines are doing it. They don't like telling stories.
That's right.
They want to just, you know, crunch through the numbers and, you know, give us answers.
Yeah.
So it may seem less, but it's so powerful that I think that's exciting.
I agree.
what does your day-to-day research look like? What sort of things, I don't know, like what?
Like my job or my research?
I guess you don't have to talk about all the faculty meetings you go to and stuff, but you know, like what would a day-to-day or the research of a student of yours now or something like that, what type of stuff would they be doing?
Yeah, and they do, so it is across the board in a way. I let students, if they want a traditional observing style project, we do that still. Like we're involved in.
You would say hey, have a telescope night and.
Yeah, so you can do these case studies on interesting objects.
But would it also be like a follow-up of something that your machine learning algorithms found? And so,
Ideally, but not yet.
Okay. Well, that's sort of hopefully where you're headed.
It's still us just finding it by hand. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
But then on the other extreme, a lot of my students, I mean, it's similar probably what you guys are doing. We use a lot of compute time.
Yeah.
To do a lot of linear algebra.
I see. So
we train a lot of neural nets to solve tasks for mm-hmm. us, like classifying, mm-hmm. finding interesting new physics, okay. and sometimes doing inference, meaning okay. doing the physics.
So it's yeah. a lot of, so for your students, it's a lot of coding and sort of developing developing AI, is like developing their own little AI. Yeah. That can solve some tasks that you're saying, like, this would be, you know, can you classify these, I don't know, light curves way?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So generally, lots of coding, lots of debugging.
Yes. So we are very much a coding group and a stats group.
But it's so interesting to me because I'm used to coding, like, you know, when I was in grad school, there was a lot of people doing coding. Like, when I started in grad school, it was sort of the transition to everybody was
doing.
If you're in a physics major, PhD, you better know how to program.
Yeah.
But, and that actually was kind of surprising to a lot of my cohort. But then, nobody was doing stuff like this, like writing. Well, certain I don't didn't really exist AI. I mean, I'm sure some form it existed, but so it is a very different type of coding, right? We would be coding hydrodynamical simulations of stars crashing into each other or something.
That's fair. I guess I don't know what you do.
That's okay. You don't have to. It's not a big deal.
So I think they're.
If
different.
You were interviewing me, you should do your research. But you know.
Did you do your research?
No, but I know you, and I know your stuff. I've seen you give talks before. That's good enough. That was my research.
Good.
All right. Are you ready for a profound question?
Okay.
All right. In your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
I don't think astrophysics is a necessary science. I really don't. But but on the flip side, I do think that, to me, our job is to educate the public
mm-hmm.
and to excite them about research
mm-hmm.
and to give them a vision that that's something they could do with their life and that they can see themselves being a scientist. And it doesn't have to be in astrophysics. But astrophysics is, to me, like the gateway into science.
I see. So you can think of astrophysics as because it's just so naturally exciting. People want to know how stars explode, like you say the star exploded,
yeah,
and they're like,
and
what?
Really
and
fun.
It's already automatically exciting, and you say, well, you know, that's science. Science is exciting, and it's a way of engaging people and getting people excited about science. And if those people end up curing cancer, then you know that would be great. So is that your answer?
I just want to make biologists.
You want to create the next generation of biologists through your astrophysics.
Yeah, but also I do think it's a way. I think we're faculty, so we must deeply believe in education mm-hmm. as a route to success.
Not all faculty do, but yes. But yes.
I think it is. I genuinely think it is a way to change your socioeconomic outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And I think getting people excited about science can let them see the possibility that that's true. And astronomy is very good for
that. That's a good point. That's very good. I like that. All right, so I may already know the answer to this question, but what is sort of on the horizon for you? What's the next big questions to tackle?
We are not done, like I said.
Yes.
So yeah, we need to really implement some mm-hmm. of the things. We've been theorists in a lot of ways, building the methodologies.
You are not serious, but go on. That's fine. Building, yes, you've been building the tools, but they've been put into practice to some extent.
No, they have.
But not on the big, really big data sets.
Not on the really exceptionally large data sets.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm becoming more excited about is what we talked about, this idea of, you know, rethinking, using large ensembles of data mm-hmm. as my observable. So that's really what we're starting to push on.
Okay. So the next big thing is just bigger, bigger data, right?
Yeah.
And then when we get to, what did you say it was?
Late 2025.
2020. Oh, we're almost there, huh? Like, only. Don't worry. Believe me, the years are going to pass by really quickly.
Okay.
So 2025 is nothing.
That's fair.
In my opinion, we're almost there. So that's gonna come before you know it, because you have to get all this stuff in place by the time it.
It is gonna happen before you know it. Yeah. So we are really, you know, building up machinery to run all of this code
in order to be able to handle.
Yeah.
A million. Supernovae a year.
And that's just supernovae.
And that's just supernovae. Right? That's all we talked about, but there's all kinds of other things.
20 terabytes of data every night.
When you say supernovae, I guess that's a million transients every...
No,
that's just supernovae, but there will be other things in there.
So there'll be... So active galactic nuclei don't explode. They continue to hang around. Mm-hmm. There'll be 100 million of those.
Okay. 100 million.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll just be continuously exist. On.
Yeah.
And then we'll be looking at, and we'll, 100 million black holes eating gas and spewing out stuff and us looking at it.
Yeah. There'll be
100 million.
It's wild. There'll be 5,000 tidal disruption events every year.
5,000 tidal disruption events every year. How many do we have now? Like...
Less than 100.
Yeah, it's less than 100. So a star, because I know that because like every once in a while you'll see a newspaper article saying a black hole ate up a star.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, another one.
And then you can see another one. But like, now we're, what did you say, 5,000?
5,000.
Per year?
Yeah.
So are we going to have 5,000 of those newspaper articles every year?
I hope
probably.
So. Yeah. AI will make all of them.
That's right. We'll get ChatGPT to write the article. Yeah. Excellent. That's going to be, there's going to be, so it's just, everything's transforming then.
It's wild. There's 10 billion galaxies.
10 billion galaxies that we'll be able to see with this.
Yeah.
10 billion galaxies. I have a hard time picturing that, but okay, that's a lot of galaxies. And we'll just be looking at them all.
Yep. All the time.
And so, like, yeah. That's just too much to get to, like, look at them one by one. You have to,
it's a lot, yeah.
We need to reformulate everything we're doing. And I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but that's why you're here. You design the laptops, I'll use them.
Okay.
So, great. I think that was a great answer.
Okay.
Unless you have more things you're going to list off that it's going to see. Oh, okay.
No, I couldn't remember the number of variable stars.
Oh, okay.
I think it's also 100-ish million. It's between 10 and 100.
Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll just say it's a lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
And things we didn't expect to see, of course.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Villar, for helping us out and trying to help me out in understanding what big data really means. I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll come back again sometime.
Yeah, in the summer.
Excellent.
Wow, she really knows her stuff. Honestly, I had trouble keeping up with all these really impressive data analysis techniques that she's been helping to develop. Kind of amazing how machine learning can completely change the kind of questions that we're able to ask as scientists. So thank you so much, Professor Villar, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is supported in part by the National Science Foundation under grant number AAG-2206-299. The music accompanying the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford on her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Go ahead and look up Britton Ashford's music if you want to hear more. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University.